Welcome to the Fermentation Speaker Series from the Center for Human Microbiome Studies at Stanford University School of Medicine. I am Aliza Caffrey, a graduate student in the Sonnenberg Lab here at Stanford.
I'm David Zilbert, a chef, food scientist, and author specializing in fermentation.
I'm Justin Sonnenberg, professor of microbiology and immunology at Stanford, and my lab studies the gut microbiome.
Our goal is to open up conversation around the current understanding and knowledge in the fermented food research space, and to define and promote future fermented food and health projects. Gut microbiome research has focused on the industrialized microbiome for quite some time, and a lot of the field was shaped by our understanding, particularly in North America and in Europe, looking at the role in which industrialization has shaped the gut microbiome. And so the industrialized microbiome is largely defined by the large consumption of ultra-processed foods, an increase in sanitation, increase in antibiotic use, a decrease in breastfeeding, and an increase in cesarean section, which are all ways in which we end up restructuring our environment and changing the abundance of microbes that we're actually exposed to. When we started incorporating non-industrialized microbiomes, looking at populations that consume historically large amounts of fiber, we were able to kind of start expanding our understanding of the gut microbiome and ask questions, what does the gut microbiome community look like universally? How does lifestyle, especially, again, the history of looking at populations that consumed large amounts of fiber, what does their gut microbiome look like compared to the industrialized microbiome? And how does that relate to health? But of course, we still are limiting our focus, looking at non-industrialized populations and comparing it to industrialized populations that are consuming high amounts of fiber. But that doesn't actually offer a universal view of what a non-industrialized microbiome will look like, because consumption of high amounts of fiber is still very limited based on the groups. And so we need to broaden our understanding and broaden the number of populations that we're able to study to better understand this relationship between diet, the environment, and our gut microbiomes.
Yeah, it's a great point, Aliza. I think, you know, the study of non-industrialized populations has come a long way over the past several years, but there's still this, you know, vast bias in microbiome science of studying industrialized gut microbiomes. And so we do need just a lot more data and a broader perspective on what, you know, microbiomes can look like in different populations that lead different lifestyles around the world. And our guest today, Aviaya Hauptmann, is a perfect guest to speak to this. You know, I think about this kind of what's become one of the tenets of the field. High fiber diet is great for the gut microbiome. But again, this, as you mentioned, reflects kind of biases of who we've been studying and what we've been using as a reference. So of course, industrialization has driven the loss of a lot of species in our gut microbiome and replacement by other species. We often think of a low fiber diet as one of the factors that's driving this, but there are populations that actually eat diets that are very low in plant-based dietary fiber, for instance, in Greenland. And so we'll hear about this today. We know about work that's been done focusing on the human genome using things like GWAS studies or genome-wide association studies. And these studies have pointed to the role of these diets in the Arctic that are eaten by the Inuit and other Arctic populations, that there really has been adaptation in the human genome towards diets that are to accommodate diets that are high in fat and protein. And so, you know, the question is, how has the gut microbiome actually adapted to this meat-based diet? And so we'll hear about this today and hear kind of this broader perspective of diet microbiome interactions. But our guest also is indigenous to Greenland. She does work on indigenous populations there and also the indigenous diet. And she has this really beautiful perspective on some of the sensitivities and considerations of doing this type of research. And so I think talking to her about that will be really illuminating as well.
Yeah. Aviaya and I go back maybe 4 or 5 years now. And our relationship has at times been contentious, I could say. more kind of one directionally, where I say something, publish it, or talk about it on Instagram, let's say, and she comes in and corrects me and says, you know, Zilbert, that's not the way the entire world works, you know, regarding fermented foods. And fair enough, she has absolutely opened my eyes to the diversity of how people that maybe don't get a lot of airtime in mass media or scientific studies have lived their lives, including, you know, her friends and family in Greenland. You know, all this talk about industrialized versus non-industrialized microbiomes or indigenous microbiomes makes me kind of think back to some of the core teachings I understand as a chef, that what grows together goes together. And we're just talking about recipes here, even recipes for fermentation. When you think about, you know, a classic dill pickle, you harvest Kirby cucumbers and crown dill at the same time because they grow in the same temperate climates and are ripe at the same time of the year. And that's why they end up in a jar together. And that's why we associate the flavor of pickled cucumbers and dill so strongly together. When you take that into an anthropological or an ecological sense, though, and blow that up globally, the inverse is also true. What doesn't grow together does not go together. And even thinking about the Inuit, be it in Greenland or in Canada, over the past 10,000 years, no one was harvesting fields of wheat. No one was eating cruciferous vegetables up there. So, of course, the bacteria that we would associate with those products would be absent from these people's diets. So, yeah, AVI has over time absolutely gotten me to think about that diversity of both human evolution and, you know, traditional practices. And I think it's a really great conversation that we're going to have with her today.
Today's guest is Dr. Aviaya Hauptmann. Dr. Hauptmann is an associate professor at Ilmatillasarfik University of Greenland in Nuuk. Her work focuses on understanding the interaction between microbiology, diet, and the environment, with a focus on Greenlandic diet and food traditions. Aviaya, we're so glad that you're joining us and that we're able to have this conversation today. And I think it would be really great to get started if you could share some of your background and how you got into this connection between microbiology, food, and fermentation.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor to be here with you. I am a trained biologist from the University of Copenhagen, and I always wanted to be a biologist, but I've always been very motivated about wanting to do work that had relevance to my community in Greenland. I was born and raised in Greenland, but lived a lot of my life in Denmark. So through my studies, I found out that there was a lab at the University of Copenhagen that did microbiology with Greenlandic microbes, environmental microbes, cold-adapted enzyme work. So I decided to go down that path to be able to work with something that had to do with Greenland. So for a while, I thought I would be a biotech entrepreneur. I worked a lot with applied microbiology. And then I was offered a PhD from the Technical University of Denmark, working with Arctic snow and ice metagenomes. And that was really fun. But I felt after I finished my PhD that I wanted to come even closer to something that had an interest in my community and relevance to my community. And then, of course, food is something that's close to all of us. So I started working with the food microbiology of Greenland and moved back to Greenland doing that. And then, of course, if you're a microbiologist and you work with food, obviously you will be interested in fermented foods.
It's great to have you here. Really looking forward to this conversation. You know, our lab at Stanford is focused a lot on studying diet gut microbiome interactions. And I think one of the things that we've focused on and much of the field is focused on is just the role that plant-based dietary fiber plays in fueling the gut community. And, you know, I think kind of one of the general things that people say we know is true about the gut microbiome, particularly in industrialized countries, is that we're not getting enough dietary fiber and we need to be, you know, eating more plant-based foods. You know, there's, I think, a lot of reasons that this has become one of the tenets of the field. One is maybe a bias in early studies of the gut microbiome being focused on industrialized populations. And then even when going to non-industrialized populations, quite often looking at populations that are at low latitudes that have access to a bunch of plant material, and that serving as kind of a reference point of maybe what humans have adapted to eat over, you know, long evolutionary timescales. But, it, you know, of course, there are exceptions, and there are a lot of biases in the field. And so I'm curious just to hear kind of your thoughts about that, and maybe hear a little bit more about the traditional Greenlandic diet.
Yeah, I really appreciate you bringing that perspective. And I think when I was starting my PhD, that was around the time where some of these seminal studies came out, like studies with the Hatsa gut microbiome. And I certainly noticed that there was this tendency to sort of extrapolate from that at sort of a generalizing universal level. But when you're an indigenous person coming from a community that has eaten traditionally almost only animals, then you get sort of a different perspective, and maybe you become more aware of where there might be some missing information, some missing questions that we haven't asked yet. So I really appreciate that. And that was part of my motivation to start looking into foods rather than snow and ice microbes. But yeah, the traditional Greenlandic diet, as I mentioned, is characterized by being animal sourced. So there are two themes that I always emphasize when we talk about our traditional diet. One is that it's comprised of animals, so the meat and organs of animals, but also what the animals ate. So we do have plants, but like it's been said, the most popular vegetable of the Greenlanders is what the caribou has eaten. So the caribou is a herbivore, so we would eat the plants out of the stomach of the caribou. And the other aspect is that it's non-industrial, it's non-processed. So all of the foods that are part of our traditional diet are all wild foods harvested in the wild. Animals that have lived their wild lives eating their wild foods, and then minimal processing. So minimal control in terms of fermentation, but also very often raw or dried foods that haven't been heated. So that's sort of the sort of basic elements of our diet.
Fantastic. And you touch upon a really interesting point there. And it's one that I've, you know, heard in the past, but I don't think I've seen any scientific studies about it. Maybe you could comment a little bit about what you know about the composition of meat, because I've heard that industrial produced meat has very different fat composition, for instance, than sheep that have been grazing on the tundra or something like that, that there are actually a lot of omega-3 fatty acids in some of these meats of animals that have been wild grazing. And yeah, so I'm just curious to hear. And then the other part is how that links to host adaptations, because there's well-recognized differences in the host genetics, populations that have resided at higher latitudes and eaten more meat or diets with higher fat composition for how our human genome, or how the human genome of these populations deals with that, and the interplay of, you know, how much of this you think in terms of like a healthy diet that can be meat-based is due to the fact that the meat composition is different versus the fact that there have been actual genetic adaptations on the human side.
Yeah. Well, there are certainly elements of both of those things, but to say like, what is the, like to put percentages of each, I think would require some really complex research. But if we could start with the composition of the food itself, there have been studies for, yeah, decades, maybe even longer, that have looked at the nutritional composition of Arctic foods. And some of the more recent ones that have compared to industrial sort of meat counterparts have shown that, for instance, that Arctic reindeer meat has higher levels of B12 and iron and zinc and selenium compared to both, well, industrially processed beef, lamb, pork, and chicken. So there's the aspect of the vitamins and those type of nutrients. But then, as you mentioned, the fatty acid composition is sort of a major part of that, that there's a significantly higher level of omega-3 fatty acids in animals that have eaten their wild foods compared to animals that have been fed grains. So yeah, there are those aspects. And for me, it's important also to highlight that if you want to compare sort of a Western or American, Northern European perception of eating animals to an Arctic indigenous sort of view of what eating animals means, it's important to also include that we eat the whole animal. So it doesn't just include the steak or sort of the chops or like those meat parts that we all know from the grocery stores. It includes the liver, the kidneys, all of those things. The blood is very important, the intestinal content, as I mentioned before. So when thinking about a meat-based diet from an Arctic perspective, it's very important that those things are included. And we often forget that in research, for instance, that looks at sort of a high animal sourced American diet would typically not include those types of foods. And then there's everything else, like how food connects us to families and communities and the environment, which are things that are also not included when we talk about sort of the health benefits of foods in sort of a modern setting. And if I can just go on to the second part of the question about genetic adaptation of Inuit to the Arctic diet. So I know that there's been quite a lot of research in sort of genome-wide association studies on the human genomes of Inuit, especially from Greenland. We have a very particular genetic makeup because we come from a small founder population. So it's actually possible to see some pretty good signals for adaptations to different things. And what has been shown is that we have some genetic and physiological adaptations to a diet rich in polyunsaturated fatty acids. And that's sort of the most significant thing that you see signals for that in loci that deal with those things. And then there's also sort of what you might call sort of the other side of that, which is that we've not genetically adapted to a diet rich in sugars. So we have very high prevalence of diabetes, and a lot of that can actually be explained by a single genetic variant that's very common in our population that has one of the highest associations that have been found between an LL and a disease. So yeah, certainly our genetic makeup has adapted in a certain way to this diet.
Super interesting. And I think, you know, it kind of brings up this next question, which is the question of microbiome adaptation. Of course, the famous example of this with kind of dietary cultural significance is the incorporation of enzymes to degrade seaweed polysaccharides in Southeast Asians, where seaweed is very prominent in the diet. And whether you're aware of or looking for adaptations like that that may have incorporated into microbes and been selected for due to the diet there.
Yeah, we've not looked for it yet, or we've not found anything yet. But one thing that I keep thinking about while doing my research is sort of this, the acknowledgement that if we don't feed our guts fiber, we lose those, you know, the ability to, or the microbiome loses the ability to degrade fiber with time, as your lab has shown many times. So when I think about our indigenous community and how they lived maybe 300 years ago before colonization with a diet that contained between 0 and 2% fiber perhaps throughout the year, what I've sort of been thinking about is that we would not have had Prevotella, for instance. We would not have had microbes that were well adapted to deal with fiber. And one of the things that I've come across is that, so we've eaten the content of the caribou stomach, and we did some research with that and showed that there was a high prevalence of Prevotella in there, which of course makes a lot of sense because the caribou eats a lot of fiber. But for a person who does not have a gut microbiome adapted to fiber, that's a really good way of eating fiber if you eat it together with the microbes that can actually break them down. So maybe those microbes would only be in the gut transiently, but at least you wouldn't, you know, have probably you would get the benefit from the fiber if you ate the microbes together with it. And I come across sort of some historical indications that show that we might not have had those microbes, which is this sort of an anecdotal piece of history that mentioned that people would say that if you want to eat seaweed, you would have to sort of accept that the first time you ate them, you might get an upset stomach or you might have a stomach ache. But then you would, if you ate it again, you would feel okay, which I found really interesting and sort of supports that idea that we might not have sort of consistently had microbes that could degrade fiber in our stomachs before.
Yeah, amazing. It's like the original symbiotic where you're giving the food and the microbes together and you get the synergy from that. Yeah, very cool. You're a native of Greenland and you're doing research focused on the gut microbiome associated with indigenous foods and gut microbiomes. I think it's a really rapidly evolving in a positive way. Part of the field of microbiome research is paying close attention to how this sort of research is done. And so I'm wondering if you could just share your perspective of working with indigenous populations and how you think that should look from a researcher's perspective and just kind of some wisdom for the overall field.
Yeah. So I think for me, what's very important to say is that you have to have an understanding of the context. So as microbiologist, and I know that from my own initial approach to this area of research, we can tend to focus on the microbiology alone and be interested in just what the microbes are showing us. But more and more, after diving into historic literature about our diet and also more current descriptions about our people and our foods, I've realized how important it is to really have an understanding of the context, an understanding of why people make these foods, and what are their relationships to these foods? How are things changing? What are sort of overall dietary transitions that are happening in those societies? So for me, what that has meant is that rather than going in and just wanting to understand the microbiology, I'm really trying to understand, for instance, the importance of fermented foods for health at the sort of broadest possible level of understanding for spiritual, emotional, communal health, also not just physical health. Those are some of the things that I find important in this work, to have an understanding of context. And for me, that also means that there's a risk that if we go in and take samples and take them out of the context and try to understand them out of context, there's a risk of misinterpretation. And we've worked with this from sort of the reason that we started working with this was because we looked at what kind of microbes do we see in a lot of Arctic fermented foods, and we see a high prevalence of Clostridia, for instance. And we know from both current day contemporary scientific literature and also historic literature that there have been problems with botulism. And a lot of researchers have sort of a inner drive to solve problems. So we might latch on to that and want to sort of, you know, solve the problem of botulism, for instance. But I think if you understand context, if you understand why people make these foods, it will make you realize that these people have not gotten sick from the foods that we've sampled. So even though that there are Clostridia in these samples, they're not harmful. So maybe that might be sort of an avenue to start questioning what's the role of Clostridia in fermentation. Is there some missing understanding about Clostridia that we could learn from respecting Inuit knowledge about these foods are healthy, these foods are important, these foods are not harmful? If we start from there and then see Clostridia, I think we're expanding the types of questions that we'll ask about fermented foods in general. And I'm not sure whether or not they will be relevant to the podcast. You can include it or not. But I realized that while I was studying I think it was during my master's in a course on medical microbiology, the textbook that we had said that a microbiologist could never recommend anyone to eat fermented seal flippers. And it said so in our textbook. And, you know, science is supposed to be objective and sort of just stating facts. And this was like an opinion, a very strong opinion in a textbook. And, you know, I've never learned so much about fermentation as I have from people who ferment seal flippers.
Yeah, I think that's just, yeah, incredible perspective there. Understanding context and kind of overlaying such biases from very specific other cultures onto indigenous research can be just massively problematic. So that's, yeah, really, really interesting. You know, you mentioned earlier the predisposition for not dealing with sugary foods very well in the Inuit genome, and I'm wondering how the forces of industrialization are kind of impacting life in Greenland, and also just if you've been able to see any signatures in the microbiome, you know, just kind of the larger picture of as you know, industrialization spreads, what the impact is. I know I've heard of this example of milk being recommended for children there that are actually lactose intolerant, and that kind of disruption of the access to native foods may be problematic from the standpoint of calcium absorption and compensating for that with a food that's totally inappropriate for the children there, and whether there are other examples of that.
Yeah. It's a really important question. So I think it's more so the process of colonization more than the process of industrialization, even though those two things are quite closely connected. But you're right now, as it is, all families are recommended that their children should drink half a liter of milk a day in Greenland, even though most Greenlanders are lactose intolerant. And also, studies have actually shown that there's a genetic adaptation against getting a lot of calcium. So researchers have actually recommended that we have a lower amount of calcium. Otherwise, we could have some sort of eye damage. This is not my area of expertise. So I don't know the specifics of it. But as it is, because we were a former colony of Denmark, our diet recommendations lean quite closely towards the Danish type diet, which is sort of a Northern European agricultural diet with a heavy emphasis on milk. And still today, we are sort of in a process to understand the strengths of our own food system, which is really what I'm interested in, to understand, like, what are the microbes that we could get from eating our own foods, including some of those foods that actually have high calcium content. So we have this small fish, which is sort of very central part of my research, the dried capelin, which if we look at the microbiome of the traditional way of drying, there's a higher diversity compared to when we industrialize that process. So of course, this gives us a basic understanding that moving towards a more streamlined industrial process diminishes the diversity of microbes that we eat from our foods. But also the capelin has higher content of calcium per gram than milk does, and lots of omega-3s and other great things. And it's a cheap food that's available to most families. So this is, of course, one of the ways that our history of colonization has impacted our relationship to food, which I strongly believe has also impacted the gut microbiome. What I'm really curious about is to expand that to go beyond food. Like, we used to live in peat houses, right? We used to sleep and eat and live in soil. And what better source of microbes than soil? So that's one of the things that I'm really curious about, like how general lifestyle before moving into houses, before the way that we live today, sort of lifestyle in the Arctic might have influenced the microbiome.
Totally. That's really fascinating. Throughout this conversation, you've mentioned fermentation a few times. And so it would be great to dive into that, because we usually think of fermentation, or at least from the kind of, you know, Western perspective, it's always about vegetables. You ferment the vegetables or you ferment the dairy, which, as you've mentioned, are not available necessarily in Greenland, and they're not part of the traditional diet. But when you have a diet that is rich in meat and organs of especially marine mammals, microbes still play a very significant role in the processing of those foods. So could you tell us a bit about how microbes have played a role in your foodways?
Yeah, I'd love to. So when I started doing this research, I was focused on our dried foods because those are part of my family, sort of like a core thing of my family's food traditions. So I didn't know a lot of Greenlandic fermented foods because I think on a day-to-day basis, those are not sort of the core. And also they're very geographically specific. And being born in Nuuk and living now in Nuuk, the capital, is not really the area where a lot of the fermented foods are made. But then when I started actually researching what fermented foods we have, I really believe that fermented foods were a major part of diets just one or two generations ago, and certainly before colonization. So the types of fermented foods, it's everything you can imagine from the Arctic. It's heads of hooded seals, it's blubber of seals, it's walrus and seal. And some of these are historical examples, but a lot of them are also still made today in certain geographic locations. So seal is sort of the cornerstone of our diet. And you can ferment it in many different ways, it turns out. Blood of seal, intestines of seal, shark. And then there's a sort of category of fermented foods that I include here, which is sort of the intestinal content of different animals. So that would be intestinal content of the caribou, intestinal content of the ptarmigan, this small white land bird. It's a herbivore. Also the intestinal content of muskox, so mussels, bivalves out of the stomach of, no, sorry, muskox, walrus. So the intestinal content of walrus, which would usually be mussels, these bivalves that you would eat out of the walrus. And cod is sort of a regular fermented food around the Nuuk area. And there's both sort of fermented cod made in the summer where they hang, and then fermented cod made in the winter where you put them in layers of snow. And deer tongue, I'm just reading up because I have a long list. Then there's sort of something that's become quite famous, which is the giviak, fermented seabirds that are sewn into a seal skin, which is a tradition in the very northern part of Greenland. Eggs, seabird eggs are also fermented. So those are examples. Seal oil is also a very common one. So fermented seal blubber that sort of renders the oil. So fermented seal oil.
And do you have an understanding of the role that fermentation played in terms of, was it primarily to preserve the food or to enhance nutrient content or palatability? What is the intention with a lot of these? And is there a historical precedent for the understanding of Greenlanders and microbial life? Like, was this kind of this awareness that the microbes were playing a role, even if there might not have been language for it?
That's a really good question and something that I've been looking for and not quite found, like, really solid. Like, there's the understanding of, like, you know, what foods to eat and how your stomach reacts. But like a microbial understanding is not something that I've come across yet. But because I have like this idea, something that impacts our lives so much, you have got to have had an understanding of it. So I'm sure it's there. It's probably just not, you know, put in the historical literature, this sort of innate understanding of microbiology. And then the importance of microbes around are like, why do you ferment foods? And I think it's all of the things that you mentioned. It's very sort of straightforward to imagine how a lot of the fermentation practices evolved. If you think about, so the way that Greenland was populated. Our ancestors came in from Canada over and then moved into completely unknown land down the west coast of Greenland. And what people would do is that if you had sort of an abundance of some type of food, that could be the seabirds that come into northern Greenland in May, for instance, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of them, you would preserve some for later. Or if you came across an area with an abundance of seals, you would harvest more than you could eat in one go, which is sort of taboo. You would not usually do that. But you would do that if you didn't know what the land you were going into, because you might be moving hundreds of kilometers down south and then find no food. So what you would do is that you would bury the food under rocks because you didn't want the polar bears and the wolves and the foxes to get at the food. And then you would proceed. And if there wasn't no food, or if someone was coming after you, they would be able to see this sort of, yeah, pile of rocks and know that there was food there. So there's sort of the preservation aspect, which just automatically results in a fermentation practice. To me, at least, it seems pretty straightforward how the fermentation practice evolved as a way to preserve food. And then the fermentation just, you know, it happens when you put seals under rocks, they start fermenting. But also, I can see from the historic literature that if people had a choice, which people would often have in the Arctic, to either freeze or let things ferment, they would choose the fermented version. So you could either put things at around ground level and they will freeze over in the wintertime, or you can dig them further down and they will ferment. And then people would actually go, you know, that extra length to have the fermentation. And there's been different hypotheses, sort of knowing that we don't have trees around here. We don't have a lot of things to create fire with. So to be able to sort of release nutrients more easily compared to eating raw meat, fermentation practice, you know, will start releasing some of the nutrients so that sort of your body's effort can be less than if you just eat the raw meat. But there's also aspects of how it heats up your body. And that's what people say a lot today. If you eat some of those fermented foods, they will actually like heat up your body, which is you can need if you live in a place that's like minus 20 to minus 40 degrees Celsius in the wintertime.
And the preservation of the some of these methods is phenomenal from what I understand. I mean, I heard the recent episode of Gastropod that you were on that talked about the Arctic diet. And I think they were talking about kivyak, but it was some method of storing food in a seal skin and then capped off with oil and then sewn up to exclude all the oxygen. And I think in one of these kind of storage areas that you talked about where you leave food kind of behind, they found some that may have been decades old and actually ate it, and it tasted super fresh, they said. So, I mean, it's just mind-boggling to think that food can sit for that long and still taste, you know, really, really delicious and kind of, yeah, undisturbed by environmental forces.
Yeah. It's, I mean, certainly also is a matter of taste, right? Because there are some really hilarious accounts of sort of European expeditions bringing along Inuit guides and the Inuit guide finding a fermented seal and wanting, like, being so happy and really, you know, thrilled that they could bring this seal back to their community, and the European explorers being like, we can't have this seal on the boat. It's too smelly. And then, you know, having a conflict over that is, yeah, there are some funny accounts.
And just to kind of clarify, so there's no salt and there's no heat, right? It's just the cold temperature, I guess the snow in some cases.
Yeah, exactly. It's so, yeah, I know in the list of questions, there was this about the definition from the ISAP, like about fermented foods. And if we look at that definition, I think the definition itself is great. It's fine. But in the ISAP definition, they sort of back up their definition to say that it's sufficiently broad to be able to distinguish between things that are fermented and things that are rotten or spoiled. And when they do that, they say that things that are fermented are deliberate and controlled. And I think that's the part that I, you know, coming from sort of an Arctic fermentation practice perspective, would question. So it's because what I read into the ISAP definitions that it's controlled by human beings. But the fermentation practices that we see, a lot of them at least, are controlled by the sun and the weather or the microbe or the animal that is, you know, digesting its food. So it's not human controlled, and it's very little control in the sense of temperature and salt, or no control at all in sense of temperature and salt.
And as climate change continues to transform our weather patterns, snow accumulation and temperature, how is that changing the Greenlandic foodways?
We see especially in northern Greenlandic and eastern Greenlandic communities where they still have a lot of hunting on the sea ice, that's where climate change is impacting communities and food systems the most. So it's only like across Greenland, it's only about 20% of our diet that's comprised of our traditional diet. All other foods are store-bought, but for some communities that still have a lot of hunting skills and have that culture alive, the climate is definitely impacting the traditions there. So especially for sea ice hunting, getting certain fish like the halibut and seals during the wintertime, not being able to move around with dog sleds in the wintertime because the sea ice is too weak is a big problem.
And so has there been a loss in these fermentation techniques, or has there been an adoption to making them in some sort of fermentation vessel or using alternative meat? What has been kind of the response to some of this?
So from my experience, the climate has not changed enough that there has been made adaptations like that. What I've seen is that we've been working with fermented seal blubber from southern Greenland, and there was a year where we couldn't get any because the sea ice had not come around. So the sea ice comes down the east coast of Greenland and then up again on the west coast, and it brings with it the hooded seal that you need for fermented seal blubber. And because there had been no sea ice, there were no seals, so there was no fermented blubber. So in that way, people just, you know, then you go a year without it. And maybe in 50 years, we'll start to see that those practices might be lost because of the climate change, but we're not there yet.
I know that you have played this really important role in this SILA program, the Scientific and Indigenous Teaching of Life in the Arctic, which I heard a presentation you gave on it and I thought was absolutely fascinating. And I wish I had learned science through this approach. But could you explain it to the listener a little bit and just kind of show us a little bit of how you are approaching a lot of the teaching of Greenlandic foodways to students while also making really great scientists?
So in my work with our foods, it's been really a big revelation how much we can learn from them, not just the microbiology, but so much more also about our relationship to our environment, sustainability, about culture and so many things. And a lot of that learning has inspired the design of the SILA program. So we've designed a bachelor in biology that includes a lot of our cultural understanding of the animals. So we'll start to have students in February next year, in less than 10 months. We're really excited about it. And they will, instead of having sort of the classic siloed courses that I had when I was a student at the University of Copenhagen, where we had, microbiology in one course, and then we had genetics, and then we had statistics, and then we have biochem. Then we'll have a course in the caribou, and we'll have a course in the fermented cod, and we'll have a course in the seal. And then based on those sort of those beings, we'll be able to to learn biology, but biology in context of a lot of different things, in context of food culture, but also in context of being able to, how to behave in the environment. How do you go caribou hunting? How are you respectfully engaging with the environment? But you can learn biochemistry, pH chemistry, and microbiology from the stomach of the caribou too.
I'll chime in here. And but I remember it was some months ago now that you were talking to me about taking a trip to Canada and the absurdity of having to fly all the way back to Copenhagen and then take a transatlantic flight to Ottawa and then, you know, take a small propeller plane over to Nunavut, where you were, I think, invited for a symposium or a talk. And, you know, I pulled up a map of the world with the Arctic at its center and drew a line from Greenland to Nunavut. And it was like a 2-hour flight. You finally caught that flight, right? You did manage to find a chartered direct flight that saved you probably, yeah, a day of travel, which is wild. But I'd like to kind of...
A King Air, and it was like 1.5 hours.
Amazing, yeah. Amazing. Yeah, much less probably jet fuel too. But I'd like to talk to you about the ties between fermented foods that connect people all throughout the Arctic and connect the Inuit, you know, spanning the Arctic Circle before there were national borders and... You know, these made up lines, you know, your ancestors traveled across sea ice and in you know, skin canoes to get from one place to another. And that heritage obviously permeates the entire region. Growing up, I remember, you know, Inuit educators coming to my school and showing me pemmican and things like that. But going further up to the Arctic, in my own research, I've come across Canadian Inuit ferments like a fermented walrus called, and forgive me if I'm butchering this, but Igunak. Yeah. Is there anything like that in Greenland, or do you see commonalities between the fermented foods of maybe the Sami people in you know, Sweden's Arctic and Greenlandic Inuit and Canadian Inuit?
Yes. So what, okay, how do, so many things that I want to say at once. Yes, there are commonalities. And as I mentioned earlier, the fermentation practice was a way for us to make that travel from the Arctic. You know, our ancestors came from the Arctic into Greenland, and our living here in Greenland was dependent on us fermenting seals. And that practice certainly, you know, is reflected across Canada and Alaska too. And Igunak, it's called the same in northern Greenland. And, you know, before cars, before roads, it was ocean water that connected people. So you would really, like, Canada and Greenland, especially in the more northern part, it was one community. And then at some point, someone decided that there should be a border and families were disconnected. And it's a big trauma and something that a lot of people mentioned to me when I was in Iqaluit, was this sorrow of having lost connection with families on the Greenland side. But our food traditions are very connected, with the sort of caveat that fermentation practices everywhere are so localized. So it's about what you have in that place, and what the environment is in that place. It's a very place-specific and season-specific practice that I think is one of the beautiful things about fermentation, really. And then you mentioned the Sami, and a few years ago, I was at a sort of the first Arctic Indigenous Peoples Food Congress, I think was what they called it. There hasn't been a second yet, but I'm really looking forward to it. It was just in the days that COVID hit. We had a lot of fun though. And what I learned there was that the Sami have also used the stomach content of the caribou for many different things. And that's one of the things that it sounded like for some of their communities, it was more several generations back, while here maybe 10 years ago and even last year on a few occasions, you could go down to the hunter's market and buy stomach content of the caribou. So it's still sort of a living food practice. And it sounds like in Norway, at least, it's been a while since that was sort of a living practice.
Further to, this idea of a living practice of not just the microbial cultures, because the way that you describe many of these fermentations, you know, it's the endemic microbiota that are transforming the foods. But it is the knowledge that your forebears kind of passed on to you when you know, reading your articles, hearing your stories, showing you when it was right to bury the wall or the seal in the ground, or understanding, you know, the humidity in the air or the temperature in the season. So I totally, and I know that we spar lots about definitions and our ideas about fermentation. But when you mentioned that it's less about control in that definition, the amount of human control that is the cultural practice that you describe in all these fermentations, to me, that's the deciding factor, you know, between rotten and, you know, successful kiviak, let's say. You know, if you don't get all the air out, if you haven't been shown how to soap the seal properly, if it's not buried under the right amount of rocks, or if you do it at the wrong time, these are all the human elements of control that you do bring into the scenario that define these products and have defined your food ways. I only mention this because there was an interesting study that I came across recently talking about Igunak from Nunavut, where, and it was commissioned by Inuit researchers who were kind of investigating these food ways to document them. There was like a commission to be like, let's document this. Let's go to all of these, you know, tribes that aren't connected to roads. Let's go and look at these traditions and document what we find. And what was fascinating to me, what stood out in this one paper, was that, you know, it was a microbiological study and they were looking for pathogens. And interestingly, in instances where someone who didn't know how to do it properly was recreating it for them, just based off of like secondhand knowledge and saying, oh, my like great aunt used to do this, I haven't done it for a while, but sure, I can get some for you. Those were the instances where they found potentially harmful human pathogens. But when they went to go find grandmothers or grandfathers who've been doing this since their childhood, they always came up clean, quote unquote. Do you see a potential for the loss of the human component of the cultural transmission as Inuit in Greenland or elsewhere in the world become more adapted to Western diets, become more adapted to imported food, and don't carry on these traditions? Do you see it as like that kind of that invasion, that creeping in of this like untamed wilderness that kind of harms the system? Do you see it from a cultural perspective as well happening? Or what are your thoughts on that idea?
Again, so many thoughts. But so what we've seen, not in my research, but other research conducted in Greenland, is that young people are in sort of becoming urbanized, moving away from families to go to high school and university. And they are sort of losing a taste for these types of foods. You know, the industrial palate is affecting all of us, and these are acquired tastes. So that's where we've seen that creeping in. But and I know from the Inuit Circumpolar Council in Alaska have done some incredible work on food security and food sovereignty. And some of the elders there have also noted that it's very important that our young people learn these practices, because they are the ones who need to sort of make sure that they are living practices, as you said. But I'm also really impressed that they continue to exist, despite 300 years of colonization, despite our diet recommendations never mentioning seal, never mentioning walrus, never mentioning whales that are the cornerstones of our diet, these practices continue to exist. So I think it's important to not assume that they will go extinct, because that's what I see sometimes around conversations with our food culture. It's sort of an assumption that aligns well with other assumptions around Indigenous peoples, that they either don't exist or existed in the past only, or will not exist in the future. And I think it's very important for us as a Inuit community to assume that our foods will exist in the future, and to sort of have that be the foundation of our decisions about how we do things. And that's one of the reasons that I have emphasized our food culture and our way of looking at our environment in the Sila biology program, because I know that our way of relating to our environment, our food ways, can be part of the future too. And there's a lot that we can learn from them that we wouldn't learn if we just allowed sort of a Northern European Western food culture to take over completely.
Yeah, totally. And I really, it's poignant what you said about, you know, just because you see a shift, or just because you hear these stories, or that someone is documenting a disappearance, does not mean that it, you get to choose what reality you inhabit or you create. And so, yeah, that is extremely touching when you say, well, if we assume that these foods will keep existing, then that's your, that's like your ground floor for ensuring that they will. Yeah. And I mean, speaking of then cultural sustainability, which is exactly what that is. What important questions do we still need to understand to tie questions of the sustainability of these foods, their production, and the cultural sovereignty that they embody, and health together? How do fermented foods in Inuit communities kind of intersect some of those ideas?
Yeah, I think for me, it's not so much about answering unanswered questions. It's more about allowing Inuit to, you know, express their knowledge and respecting that knowledge. It's more about not assuming that it's only scientific knowledge that is valid, so that we as scientists will actually listen to Indigenous communities and see them as the experts of their foods. We might want to have questions answered, but it's because we don't know those foods. It's because we don't know that way of seeing the world, that to us, we think about it as unanswered questions. But a lot of knowledge is sort of not in the scientific realm. And for me, it's, for instance, respecting that an animal-sourced diet in a particular place, in a very particular way, can be both healthy and sustainable, rather than having to prove that, just respecting that Indigenous communities already know it. I hope that makes sense somehow.
Yeah, it absolutely does. Absolutely does.
But also lots of microbial questions that could be fun to answer. Like, how does an Arctic Indigenous diet impact the gut microbiome? And we have a crazy chef who's been kayaking for thousands of kilometers, eating only Greenlandic foods. And we're looking very much forward to digging into his gut microbiome.
Mike Keen.
Yes, you know him.
Yeah, he's a fun guy. When he passed through Copenhagen, we met up and he talked to me about his grand ambitions. This is before anything was set, but he just had a kind of spark of an idea in his mind. And I'm glad you guys connected. Aviaya, could you describe some of the flavors and textures associated with a few examples of some of the foods that you've mentioned so far?
Yeah. So as I've mentioned, our fermented foods are very geographically specific, but in Nuuk where I live, fermented cod is sort of one of the most more common fermented foods. And fermented cod is delicious. So those are some of the fermented foods that we don't eat raw. So fermented cod needs to be boiled or cooked before it's eaten. And it has this ammonia-like aroma that comes from the TMA in the cod. And then I had the privilege of tasting a fermented eider egg when I was in the very north of Greenland. And it's, I mean, for people who like strong, hard cheeses, it's an amazing flavor. And I like strong cheeses, so it's just amazing. It had very sort of creamy consistency, but it's frozen when you eat it. So it's fermented and frozen. So it's, you know, a frozen raw egg that has fermented. It's delicious. And it's really beautiful too. I've not tried the giviak, but it has, like, the aroma of it is very much like black olives to me. Very similar to black olives. And then around here, what's common too is a traditional fermented food from southern Greenland, the fermented seal blubber, iginnak. Sounds a lot like igunak, probably the same word. And iginnak can have sort of this sort of fruity flavor to it, but also to some, like a synthetic flavor, almost like a plasticky flavor to it too. It's really delicious.
Well, speaking of that, you know, we'll just wrap up with some final questions here and some fun ones that we ask all of the guests on the podcast. But what's inside your fridge? What does your fridge look like? What ferments have you been eating lately? And does any of the stuff that you've talked about today kind of sit at the back or is in high rotation? Or tell us.
No, I don't have it's not part of our weekly rotation to have our traditional fermented foods. We have fermented seal blubber in the freezer for when we eat dried fish. And so it's a little bit like, sort of Italian pairing with olive oil and bread. We have dried fish or dried meat with the fermented seal blubber. So I have that in the fridge. And then it's in the freezer. In the fridge, it's probably more sort of Danish type fermented foods, lots of cheeses and some sausages that are made here locally from wild caribou meat, but perhaps they aren't really fermented. They might be just smoked. And then what do I have? I have skyr, milk products of different kinds. And a sourdough that my husband takes care of to make our family's rye bread for lunch for the kids. Yeah, that's probably about it.
Oh, speaking of your family, I know that you've mentioned that you go to great lengths to expose your children to some of these foods and your practices when you take them to Greenland and the things that you grew up with. But your husband is Danish, correct?
Yes.
How has he gotten a taste for some of these traditional Greenlandic foods as well?
Yeah, my husband is not a picky eater. So we've lived in Tokyo and different other places and he can eat everything. I'm much more of a picky eater than he is. And I remember when we were in Alaska some years ago, we went to this beautiful gathering with a lot of Inuit foods and a lot of fermented foods. And he ate so much that I can't eat because I didn't grow up with it, but he can. So he did not have to develop a flavor. He's just not a picky eater. But what he has developed is hunting skills, which is great. Because when I first introduced him to Greenland, I remember him saying something like, nah, it's not really his thing, like fishing and hunting. And I thought, this is never going to work out. But he's a good hunter now. So he hunts caribou and ptarmigan. And we fish, our kids fish. And those practices are very important to me.
Amazing. Okay, another question then. What's currently exciting you in the space of fermented food research? What's got your attention these days?
What I really like about fermented food research in general is that it allows us to work interdisciplinarily. Like it really opens up some borders that have existed between silos in research so that we can work outside the biosciences so that microbiologists can work together with philosophy and sociology and indigenous knowledge. And I think that's really exciting. That's what I find exciting.
And in your own work, what's the next big thing you're working on, or are you wrapping anything up of your own projects that we can tune into soon or read about?
Our focus in my lab right now is gastrophagy, eating of intestines, and what's the microbial potential in that, because that's some of the food culture that a lot of different food cultures have sort of are doing less and less, and in some food cultures, not at all. But we still have a pretty good common practice of eating intestinal content here. So I'm curious about how that has given us microbial diversity, like what better place to get gut microbe diversity than from other animals' gut microbes. So that's sort of ongoing work. A little bit of it is coming to a close now. And then the next thing, I would love to sort of put the food in the context also of just how we lived. So I mentioned briefly, like we used to live in peat cabins and peat houses. We used to live in soil. We used to live together with our dogs. That's how we got to Greenland. That's how we moved around with dog sleds. So living closely with dogs of the type that we've lived with and living in peat cabins, like opening up to understand how that has impacted skin microbiome, oral microbiome, gut microbiome, everything, general well-being, but also in the context of just not just microbially, but socially and other aspects of that as well is something that I would really love to go into next.
Yeah, I had to do an essay ages ago about the future of restaurants, and I was just drawn to the idea of, again, being raised in Canada, of Haudenosaunee longhouses, you know, these built out of wood that house multiple families with communal eating areas. And yeah, it does paint a very different picture as a way of life to drywall, you could say, and individualized apartments for sure. And microbially, of course, why wouldn't a living house be full of bugs that live with you, really? And tell us, Aviaya, but where can listeners read more about some of this work or find you online?
I'm just sort of settling our research group, so we don't have like a formal web page or anything that people go to, but I'm pretty active on Instagram and I will post good news there, developments that have happened, so people can find me on Instagram.
Well, thank you very much for your time, for your knowledge.
Fantastic conversation. Thanks for sharing all of that, really.
Yeah, thank you all for your time. I really appreciate this opportunity. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us for a conversation with Dr. Aviaya Hauptmann. For more information, visit us at goto.stanford.edu/fermentation series, or just search for Fermentation Speaker Series Stanford on any search engine and sign up for our newsletter. For more conversations like this one, please subscribe on Spotify. If you do have any questions, ideas, or comments, we do want to hear from you, so email us at fermentationseries@gmail.com. Music by Sam Fisher. Special thanks to Monica Cryan for her support.